no signs of life. Please don't tell me that the human race did not survive. There are no people in the future. There are no people. There are no people in the future. No people at all. There are no people in the future. Where did all my people go? There are no people in the future. Let me try my people call.
Buddy, happy Monday. Welcome to Raging Chickens, Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is our call-in show from Monday, March 1st. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts from our own backyards from across the country. On Fridays, Sean Kitchen and I, and what I'm told I have to refer to for whatever reason as our flagship show, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly on Fridays in state and national politics. You can get both this podcast and our flagship show by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. But you can only join the show live, the conversation live, and call in on a Podbean app on most Mondays at 7 p.m. Sometimes we go a little bit earlier. Sometimes we bump it a day, depending on our guest. But most of the time, it's Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern. And if you're watching us on YouTube, yes, we are streaming live to YouTube, too, as well. Make sure you smash that subscribe button, hit the bell, and like the stream. The more you like it, the more you subscribe, the more we get to get the voices that come on this show out to the world. Amplify is in order. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to the show on the Podbean app, you can show us some love right now. You can drop a few bucks in our tip jar by clicking on that little gift icon at the bottom of the screen. Yes, you can fill your digital pockets with Podbean's golden beans. That's what they call them. It's like Podbean's Bitcoin, I guess, or something like this. When you can send us a gift of your choice. Every gift that you send helps support and expand this podcast. And if you're looking for more PA progressive talk tonight, well, stay on and tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern. You can find that on his YouTube channel, his Twitter account, Facebook, wherever you get a stream, that's where Rick is. That is 9 p.m. Eastern. And make sure you subscribe to his daily podcast wherever you get your podcast. And a special shout out for all the gamers out there. Yes, I want to introduce you to the place to go for all your gaming needs. Check out the Game Inn, located right on Route 309 in Quakertown, PA. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based, Black Flammy-owned gaming store. And not only are they friends of the show, and not only just friends of the show, they're like the family, the parents, the whole family of my son's best friend, right? So I've got a personal investment in their success, let me tell you that. Their gaming store, they're friends of the show, great folks all around. They have almost every gaming product you can imagine. N64s, Nintendo DSs, PS4s, and Switch. Why get out of that, corporate mentality and support a family-owned business? And they also have a huge variety of video games, all platforms, large collection of collectibles, including action figures and Funko Pops, and kids will get discounts with every A on the report card. You check them out on their Facebook page. You can follow them on Twitter at The Game Inn. That's with two N's, Game Inn. You got a question about a game, looking for something hard to get, message them on Facebook, drop them an email at thegameinnpa@gmail.com, or give them a call at 267-424-2535. Visit them online at thegameinn.com. Let them know that Raging Chicken sent you. I'd love to hear that. And a special shout out to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongADayMan. That's with two N's once again. SongADayMan on Twitter. He's got great stuff. So on today's show, it's almost like going back to Raging Chicken's roots, because those folks who've been following us since way back when we got started back in 2011, the kind of PA's fracking country was really front and center in a lot of the coverage that we were doing back then. And so tonight I'm welcoming Sean O'Leary, and he is a senior researcher with the Ohio River Valley Institute. We're going to be talking about the Ohio River Valley Institute's, or ORVI's, new report called Appalachia's Natural Gas Counties, the Natural Gas Fracking Boom and Appalachia's Lost Economic Decade. The report examines 22 counties in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia at the center of Appalachia's natural gas boom. While the boom did wonders for the national GDP, the fossil fuel company's bottom lines, but those 22 counties did significantly worse. The promises of an economic rebirth for these economically strapped regions never came to pass. So a little background, the Ohio River Valley Institute's an independent nonprofit research and communication center. It's a think tank founded in 2020 and based in Johnstown, PA. The Institute equips the region's residents and decision makers with the policy research and practical tools needed to advance long-term solutions to some of Appalachia's most significant challenges. Their work includes in-depth research, commentary, and analysis delivered online by email and in person to policy champions, emerging leaders, and a range of community partners. And they just actually released another report. I'm telling you, the research coming out of this institute is phenomenal. Ever since I kind of came across them last fall, I've just been like on their site because it's great. They've got another report came out last week called The Failures of Fossil Fuel Subsidies in Pennsylvania. I understand they got more research coming on. So my guess is it's not going to be the last time you hear from Sean O'Leary and some other folks from the Ohio River Valley Institute too as well. O'Leary is a native of Wheeling, West Virginia, and he's written about coal and natural gas and their role in economies of Appalachia in a book, a newspaper column, and a blog called The State of My State. And previously, Sean served as the communications director at Northwest Energy Coalition in Seattle, Washington. He's also a playwright who has won numerous awards presented by the National Endowments for the Arts, the National Arts Club, and the West Virginia Commission on the Arts, among others. So I'm very, very pleased to welcome Sean to the show. Sean, welcome to the show.
Well, I thank you for having me, Kevin. I'm just thrilled to be here.
Well, I can't even tell you when this report first came out, I have said this to you before the show today, but as I was rereading it today, I got as angry as rereading it now as I was when I first read it. But before we get into the meat of this, I just want to talk a little bit about how you got into the business of writing about this stuff. I mean, how do you go from like playwright, right, to writing about and tracking down and doing research on the lies the failures of the promises of the natural gas industry here in this region?
Well, first you have to understand that no one, including me, makes his living writing plays. it's not a lucrative profession.
Fair point.
So for 20 years, I had a side gig in which I ran a marketing analytics company that did market modeling for consumer packaged goods brands. And by that, Oreo, Chips Ahoy, all of the Nabisco cracker brands. And we also worked with Pfizer Consumer Healthcare, which is Listerine, Lubriderm, Benadryl, and all of that stuff. And yeah, I was a quantitative guy in that world, mm-hmm. doing analyses of markets. And as you pointed out in your introduction, yeah, I am a native of Wheeling, West Virginia, and the Ohio Valley, which along with northeastern Pennsylvania is the other primary pocket of natural gas production. And I love the place. It's in my blood is really the bottom line for this. And back at the beginning of the fracking boom, I was watching the numbers that were being thrown around about at that time by the industry primarily and by its supporters of the kinds of job growth in particular that we would see. Mm-hmm. And so I took some of the same modeling tools that I was using in working with, you know, Pfizer and Nabisco and companies like that. And I applied them to the projections by the fracking companies. And it just didn't make sense.
There's no way.
And I wrote it. I mean, you know, you mentioned 2011 when this program started. Yep. That's also when I was writing. And I can point to the columns in 2011 that pointed out the structural barriers to the kinds of numbers that were being talked about at that time. And sadly, that's in fact the way in which it played out.
This is exactly it. And I can remember the lead up, right, in 2010 and 2011, when a lot of these numbers, you know, when a lot of the, you know, the proclamations, which are really kind of, you know, under the microscope in this report, were being made. But at the time, right, I mean, we're looking at and we're making, I mean, I remember making this case myself. I remember researchers coming out of the wall. I mean, I had worked closely with Karen Faradin, for example, with Burke's Gas Truth and what stuff that she was coming out with. Yep. And and you're just making an argument at that point, right? I mean, everybody's kind of like saying, okay, well, you just, you know, you're whatever, you know, environmentalist, or, you know, you just don't like oil companies or something like this. And it's devastating in many ways that we have to kind of be right in the kind of retrospect, if you know what I mean. I mean, because a lot of the devastation has already been done.
Yes.
And one of the things that occurred to me when I was reading this report and some of your background too, is while some folks might think it's a strange combination to say have a playwright and a quantitative analysis guy together, like in some ways, I think that's part of the strength of both of this report and kind of, I think the kind of skills that we need in one place to be able to tell the story at the same time as that we're doing the analytic stuff, because I think that the story is really what is finally beginning to sink in for here, that all the kind of, just the raw numbers by themselves just weren't breaking through now. But now it seems to be that there's enough of a story there that the numbers are meaning something, if that makes any sense to you.
Well, it does, because, and I think people are getting it. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are not convinced. And right now, the industry is going to extreme lengths to try to refute or otherwise discredit the report. But it is sinking in. People who live in the region, and I'm very familiar with the Ohio Valley because I'm from there. But they see it in their downtowns. They know these are not thriving places. When you have downtowns that are marked with empty storefronts in many cases and vacant lots where buildings have been torn down, it's quite evident that there's not a huge economic revival going on there. And the other encouraging sign to me is, of course, just in the recent presidential election, in the run-up to Election Day, in that last few weeks, when the Trump campaign was trying desperately to hang on to Pennsylvania, their line of attack was to contrast the Trump campaign's support of fracking and of the oil and gas industry in the region to what they claimed was Biden's plan to ban fracking.
Right.
And what's interesting about that is that when you look at the fracking counties, the same eight in Pennsylvania that we're talking about, the Trump's margins in those counties were actually smaller in 2020 than they were in 2016.
Interesting.
Which meant that, that attack on fracking basically got no traction.
Right.
Or if it did get traction, it brought out as many people who are appalled by fracking as it brought out who support it. And that to me is an encouraging sign, because it means that at some level, the truth is beginning to break through. And when I saw, for instance, the fervor of the objections to the report, I mean, two congressmen in Ohio issued press releases condemning the report, a group called Pittsburgh Works Together, just recently, in last week, as a matter of fact, circulated an ostensible refutation of the report to every member of the Pennsylvania General Assembly. I mean, it's clearly put the industry on the defensive right now. And that in itself, I think, is an important accomplishment.
Yes.
Because it changes public discourse about this issue.
Absolutely. So let's talk about, this report, like you said, has already kind of produced reactions for it, but it's made a splash in ways other reports that I haven't. I mean, even like the Philadelphia Inquirer, for example, this past week came out, which blew my mind. I mean, I don't know about you where you sat, but I mean, they came out with an editorial says fracking puts PA at an energy crossroads. It's time to pick a direction. And your report gets centered in this, right? And they quote John Hanger talking about the report, and they say John Hanger, who served as Pennsylvania Secretary of Environmental Protection under Governor Ed Rendell, commented on the findings saying, quote, "This report explodes in a fireball of numbers the claims that the gas industry would bring prosperity to Pennsylvania, Ohio, or West Virginia. These are stubborn facts that indicate gas drilling has done just the opposite." And then it echoes in my mind some questions that that you kind of raise in this report. And then I want to kind of like have you kind of take us into the report a little bit after this. And I think at the center of this report comes these questions. And I think that Hanger is actually kind of putting his finger on this and kind of like wanting us to pay super attention. In the report, you say the extreme disconnect between the economic output and local prosperity raises the question of whether the Appalachian natural gas industry is capable of generating or even contributing to the broadly shared well-being. And if it is not, should it continue to be the focus of local and regional economic development efforts? And I thought that really puts us right square at that kind of that crossroads that the editorial from the Philly Inquirer points us to. So let's take us back a little bit to the beginning of this stuff, because you know we're really looking at in this report the economic impact, right, and the kind of the claims that the industry made versus what the impacts are from here. Now, would that be a fair assessment of the kind of the general the scope of the report?
Yes.
All right. So take us into a little bit about how you came at this and what you found in this report.
Well, as you are probably aware, there's been an ongoing debate for years now within Pennsylvania about how many jobs in particular in the state the industry created and supports. And the industry has put out numbers ranging anywhere from 300,000 to 600,000 in Pennsylvania. And the problem with those numbers, aside from the fact that they're vastly inflated, is that it's really difficult to figure out how many jobs are associated with one industry, because you have the employment, people who are directly employed by the industry. But then, of course, the industry wants to take credit for upstream jobs, companies that supply services and products to the industry. And then there are downstream jobs when the employees of these companies start spending their money in the local economy. And that is always a tortured conversation,
right?
Because it's filled with assumptions about multipliers and other things. And so we thought, we very consciously said, wait, we're going to bypass that, because this was sold to us as an economic game changer. It was sold to us on the impact it was going to have on the economy as a whole. And so we decided in this report to just go to the numbers that are collected every month by the federal government and that are reported every month by each of the states, because that involves no assumptions. It involves no inferences whatsoever. It is, right, like the football coach Bill Parcells once famously said, you are what your record says you are.
Right.
And that's what we did, was simply report those numbers and compared them, contrasted them to the claims that were made by the industry going back a decade ago or so. And yeah, it has, and the reason we took that approach, aside from the fact that it's kind of quantitatively unassailable, although they've tried.
We'll
get to that. But the other reason that we did that is I'm not doing this just because I'm a numbers junkie. It's because I really do hope that this report will help change policy. And when you cited the Philadelphia Inquirer editorial and other things that are happening, one of the potentials that we recognized is not that we're going to get politicians who were formerly pro-fracking and pro-natural gas to flip. I mean, that's practically not going to happen. Nor is the industry going to go away next month, no matter what we do. It's right here. And, but what we can do by citing these numbers, even to supporters within the legislature, is to point out, okay, you may support the industry, but the fact is you and your constituents are getting a raw deal here. Okay, if you want to support the industry, that's fine. But at the very least, drive a deal, negotiate for a deal that actually provides some benefits. And so it's really on that basis, I think, that the Philadelphia Inquirer editorial board and others are approaching this report, because it's not there to say ban fracking or keep fracking or no, it's just the numbers. And moreover, it's actionable at a policy level, even for people who may support fracking, but who are willing to look at the objective numbers and acknowledge, crap, this really isn't working out for our county or my constituents. And so it creates, the important thing, I think, is that it creates the possibility for legislators, regardless of what their positions were prior to the issuance of the report, to look at it and say, gee, maybe we do need to negotiate a better deal on this thing. And if that means, raising taxes that there is more revenue coming into the community, or if that means enacting more stringent regulations to protect quality of life and health and other issues so there's less negative impact, which is another issue we should talk about.
Yep.
I mean, those are measures that can be taken by legislators, by policymakers, to ensure that even if the industry doesn't go away, at least these counties and these communities are getting a better deal out of it than they are now.
Absolutely. And it's funny you say this. This is one of my takeaways from the Philadelphia Inquirer editorial was precisely what you're saying there, is that, me personally, right? I mean, I'd love for them to come out with an all-out ban. We're going to ban fracking, right? That's like, if I had my druthers, that's what they, but look, I mean, I understand, like, they're newspaper editorial staff. And I think that the way that that editorial was paced does exactly what you said. I mean, at the very least, it allows those people, and again, I don't care what's in people's hearts. I care what they actually do. Okay. And if, you know, it's like, I don't know what's in their heart, if they really believe X, Y, or Z. What I know is that the position that, you know, even some say Republican or kind of pro, not even, I shouldn't say just Republican, but pro fracking, right? Legislators, they, you know, have been saying, well, we want jobs, jobs, jobs. This allows them something politically, at least, to get angry about. Right. And that anger can be like, again, all the more reasons why we should ban fracking. Or it could mean like, hey, you know, I, as a kind of like pro, like, you know, fracking legislator, was promised this thing and you guys didn't deliver on your promise. Right. And to get the industry on their heels a little bit. And then I saw, like, Rick, I mean, it's like literally right after your report comes out, then we get this finding from the Delaware River Basin Commission banning fracking. Yes. and then which then again, you talk about opening up and putting pressure upon a discussion where you could potentially fundamentally change the discourse and the arguments around this. I mean, it seems to me that this is a real opening moment in Pennsylvania's future, kind of like what the Inquirer said.
Well, it gives citizens a chance to hold their legislators accountable. You don't have to go to somebody and say, I want you to come out for banning fracking tomorrow. You know, there is something that you can do for us, your constituents, that's incremental, that's important, that will help. And that is negotiate a better deal, whether it's for more money, greater protections. There, you need to negotiate for us. And that's pressure that can be put on any legislator to do it. And it's in that I find real hope that there's room for movement. Because, yes, if I'm a legislator and I've been very supportive of this industry and I look at the numbers that are happening in, you know, in Sullivan County and Tioga County and places like that, I'm frankly kind of pissed.
Right. Exactly.
And I want to go to the industry and say, hey, look, I supported you guys. I ran interference for you. I smoothed the field on taxes, on regulations to make it possible for you guys to come here. Now it's time you got to help me out. I've supported you. You need to help me. And I think that is a real possibility. And I think it's a very fair request of constituents to make of their representatives.
Absolutely. And, you know, if any of these folks have any degree of self-preservation, desire for self-preservation as like a politician, right? I mean, that's something that they'd want to be able to mobilize. Say like, hey, wait a minute, you know, you promised this and I got you these votes, right? And I told these constituents, I told them that this was going to bring jobs, and they're finding out that the promises of the big payouts, the promise about economic development, they're about the long-standing jobs and it's going to bring to this area, that has not panned out at all. So, you know, what say you, sir, kind of thing. You know?
No, and what happens, the good outcome of that is that, of course, whether it's, you know, increased taxes or whether it's greater protections for people's quality of life and health, those, frankly, are going to increase costs for the industry.
Right.
And that, combined with other market forces that are kicking in right now, including the rise of renewables that are cheaper to generate electricity with and other factors, will help hasten the industry's demise. And so there's a short game and there's a long game at work here. And both of those can work in harmony with one another if people just look at the deal they're getting now and decide that it's not enough.
Okay, let's go into this report a little bit here, because you have, like, let's get into the numbers a little bit, because you said, like you said, you kind of lay out the numbers here, and very much you've got this contrast, right? You got the contrast between what the industry brings to, say, GDP, like gross domestic product, right? The kind of, say, profits that that come out of this versus what's actually happening in these 22 counties. So lay out that contrast for us.
Yeah. Well, you have to look at both sides of the equation. The counties are making, like all places in the United States, the 22 fracking counties are making a contribution to the U.S. economy, to GDP, We hear the gross domestic product statistic quoted every month, just like we hear jobs and other statistics quoted every month.
Exactly.
And all that you have to know is that the contribution that these 22 counties are making to the U.S. economy has grown over the last 11 years three times faster than the U.S. economy as a whole. So once upon a time, these counties were basically contributing a little less than $2.50 to the U.S. economy for every $1,000 in the economy. That was in 2008. By 2019, that $2.46 had become $3.33, fully a one-third increase, a 33% increase, 35 actually, percent increase in the contribution these companies are, or these counties are making to the nation's economy. Now, in a perfect world, what you would see is comparable or proportional increases then in jobs, in income, and even in population. That would mean things are working harmoniously and to the benefit of the counties.
Right.
But in fact, what we see happened is that while the contribution to GDP increased the share by 33%, jobs only increased by 1.6%, which is statistically almost insignificant.
It's astonishing. It really is.
Yeah. And, similarly, in total, adjusted for inflation, the contribution of these counties increased overall by 61%. Income into the counties was up by 14%, which, again, compared to 61%, is trivial. Jobs were up by only 1.6%, and population actually declined by almost 4%.
So let's really lay this out. So you've got a boatload of cash that is being made here, right? So there's real money being made.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and it's all going and it's registering at the national level. That's the amount of money we're talking about here, right?
Yeah. The money happened. I mean, let's be very clear about that. The money happened. There was investment to get all those wells drilled. The wells produced a ton of gas that has been sold all over the place. And so there's a lot of sales revenue coming from the sale of that gas. The problem is that very little of that money, either on the front end when the wells were being drilled and continue to be drilled, or on the back end when the gas is sold, very little of that money actually lands in the local economy. And in fact, we will have an upcoming companion report to this that looks at that phenomenon. But we do know that when you look at that huge growth in GDP that came out of the counties, that literally 80% of the money associated with that growth went elsewhere, simply left the region altogether. And, you know, we can talk about the reasons for that because there are a number of leakage points from the very beginning of the process when we're talking about drilling wells initially, all the way to the sales process. And somebody, a neighbor of yours in that part of the country, an economist named Tom Kinnaman from Bucknell University, gets a lot of credit because back in 2011, he had started already then to identify the leakage points that caused so much of that money to land elsewhere.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, I mean, and I think you alluded to it in your introduction a little bit because, you know, one of the problems, and I'll just go kind of chronologically from the time you start drilling a well until the time you sell the gas that comes out of it and what happens with that money. We know right now, and we're working on quantifying this, but we know what the general leakage points are. So first of all, when the wells were, when the fracking boom started and the wells were getting drilled initially, a significant portion of the workers doing that work came from the Southwest, from Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana. There were relatively few local workers who were actually employed to do that work.
Oh, and I can remember this too. I mean, like I said to you before we went on the show, it was like I have family up in like up in the Ricketts Glen area, the Red Rock area, the Benton area, and I can remember the flood of Texas license plates, right? The flood of Southern plates that were coming in as that boom started, started to begin.
Yep, and just like many of the workers came from outside of the region, so did many of the supplies and so did many of the support services, because, you know, our region was kind of a virgin region for drilling for natural gas and specifically for fracking. We didn't have a heritage of doing that. And so our economy had not built up that ecosystem of suppliers and service providers that exist in the Southwest.
Right.
And so generally, companies found that it was easier to just put some folks on the road and transport them up to, you know, Appalachia, rather than try to recreate a new economy up here altogether. And so that is what happened. And so when you heard politicians, and you still hear them saying this, saying, well, you know, this company or that company is investing, $8 billion in Susquehanna County. And we are talking billions, by the way. Mm-hmm. They may have been investing $8 billion, but a lot of that investment went to pay for workers from other parts of the country, went to pay for suppliers from other parts of the country, went to pay for materials from other parts of the country. In other words, saying it was being invested in Susquehanna County
is a bit suspect.
Yeah, because it was being invested, but not there.
Right.
And so that undermined a significant portion of the projected GDP gain in the first place. But then you have the backside of this thing. And this is the work that, again, Tom Kinnaman from Bucknell University did. And that is when you look at one of the economic impact studies from back in 2010 that is specifically cited in the report, it anticipated that a great deal of wealth would flow into local economies as a result of royalty payments that property owners would receive.
Exactly.
From having gas generated. And there were a number of assumptions in those reports, which in hindsight are laughable, and frankly, which should have been laughable in the first place. The first major miscalculation that was made was that those reports assumed that the price of natural gas would really never drop below about $4.50 per million BTUs. Mm-hmm. And in fact, prices got down to less than $2. And they have only recovered to the high twos. Every once in a while, it breaks three. By now, the reports assumed that the numbers would be up over six and perhaps even $7. And so you can kind of take half the revenue off the table right at the start.
Yep.
Just never happened. Then the second thing that kicked in was that the reports assumed that the property owners, the people who would be receiving those royalties, would be Pennsylvanians. Well, in fact, it turned out that there are a lot of out-of-state property owners, many of them companies, some of them individuals, but a significant portion of that royalty revenue got siphoned off simply because the owners of especially large tracts of property often live in other places. Then there was another factor that kicked in, which is they assumed that the royalties from those, or the money from the royalties, would all be spent within 1 year in the local economy, you know, going to local grocery stores and movie theaters and hairstylists and all of the services that kind of make up the fabric of our daily lives. Well, in fact, it turns out that less than half, and perhaps as little as 5 or 10% of the money coming from royalties, even from people who lived in Pennsylvania, actually got spent in local economies. And as a consequence of that, it wasn't only the jobs on the front end that failed to manifest for Pennsylvanians. It was also those downstream multiplier-based jobs that were supposed to come from spending that also never came to fruition because the added business, the added activity in local economies didn't happen. And so when you look at even, you know, a back of envelope analysis of those kind of numbers, you can actually see how, yes, it's absolutely evident how as much as 80 or 90% of those projected dollars, frankly, would have gone elsewhere and never landed in local economies. And so it's not really a mystery, frankly, as to what happened. These are many of the factors. As I said, Tom Kinnaman from Bucknell was anticipating this back in 2010, 2011, yeah. And I was. So it's not as though it's like nobody could have known.
Well, let me ask you, and I know this is a little, this goes a little bit beyond your report, and you can, you know, feel free to kind of like, you know, say, hey, look, this is not really what we looked into. That's fine. But I mean, did you have a sense in looking at this? I know Kinnaman's work a bit, right? And about now, how much? Okay, let me. I'm just going to put it the way I normally talk. Okay, it's like how much of this was just bullshit right from the get-go, and how much of it was, say, good faith projections that the industry just got caught in this bubble? I mean, did they? I mean, because from the way that it looked on, like, from my end, right, as we were kind of moving into this, it felt like a snow job from the get-go. It felt like they had. Like projections, yes, and they were, look, I understand rosy projections, like that an industry is going to make and things like this, I get that. Yep. But it seemed to me that they already knew the questions about the infrastructure, they already knew questions about where the workers were going to come, they already knew that, you know, that the economic impact that they were promising, they couldn't possibly deliver on. And especially when they, you know, and the nonsense that came along with this, and you touch upon this in the report a little bit about, or actually this comes in some of the, you know, the people that are criticizing the report, basically saying things like, you know, yes, no, you're depriving people of their natural gas and the needs. I'm like, wait, this gas goes to China. Don't even you tell me for a second that it's going to the backyards in Pennsylvania. It's not. Right. I mean, but anyways, but I mean, how much of this was a snow job from the get go? And how much of this is just kind of like the collapse of wishful thinking?
I think a fairly generous view of many people involved in making these projections and in making these claims. I think there were some aspects, particularly in the economic impact studies that are cited in the report, where some of the assumptions that were made about the job multipliers, the income multipliers, you know, what people would do with the money they got from royalties, I think those assumptions were kind of egregious, mm-hmm. And should not have been made. And so that's that. But I'm more concerned about, and you expect the industry to do what the industry does.
Right.
I mean, the thing that I have, the people who I have real compassion for in this are, you know, local political leaders, county commissioners, local state reps and state senators, economic development authority people. Because typically they're not experts in this stuff to begin with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know as much about conditions in northeastern Pennsylvania as I do in the Ohio Valley. Yeah. But where I come from in the Ohio Valley, it's been a 60-year economic decline going back to the 1950s. I mean, my hometown of Wheeling has less than half the population it had when I was born there in the mid-1950s. And so, you know, when you're a county commissioner in Marshall County, West Virginia, or Belmont County, Ohio, and some larger-than-life character like, you know, Aubrey McClendon from Chesapeake that started the fracking boom nationally, walks into your office one day and says, hey, I want to invest $1 billion in your county.
Yeah.
And you've been sitting there watching your population decline, people move away, buildings be abandoned in your downtowns. What are you going to say when somebody comes in and says, I want to invest $1 billion? Probably something along the lines of, you know, how can I help?
Totally. I mean, no, look, I agree with you. I have 100%. I have sympathy and empathy with the folks that kind of on the ground there, especially you watch these communities that are, you know, all sorts of problems that kind of even then exacerbated by the opioid epidemic, right? You got all sorts of, I mean, I've seen these communities, I know folks in these communities, I have family in these communities, and that's what it's been. I totally get that of saying, oh my God, we might be able to save our town, right? Yeah. We might be able to kind of like get back to something where our kids are going to have decent schools again. And I get that. And of course, I guess that's what the industry in part banks on, right? Is that, you know, you've got easy targets, when it comes to actually, you know, getting them to change policy, for example, or to help, you know, facilitate, to go to this, you know, to go to the state house and say, listen, we need this. We need the kind of like, we don't want any kind of, severance tax being put on the industry because how desperate we are to have this kind of investment. So I get it on that end.
Mm-hmm. And So, you know, in answer to your question, yeah, there are clearly people, the authors of those economic impact studies who are named in the report. I mean, yep. I'm not shy about that.
No, not right.
Who frankly should have known better and could have known better. But I think as you kind of go along the food chain of this to the people who, you know, you've got the folks doing the economic impact reports who were funded by the industry, not terribly surprisingly.
Yep.
You have the industry itself and what they're going to say. They're the people who are in the faces of local policymakers and legislators. And then, of course, you have the legislators and policymakers themselves. Yeah, I mean, I think there are different degrees of responsibility for this. I think most people, particularly local people, were well-intentioned. I don't think there was a plan to rip anybody off.
Right.
And that's why I do retain some optimism that now that it's, you know, been documented and quantified how bad the deal is that they're getting, that those people who were well-meaning when they walked into this in the first place are still well-meaning and will be able and willing to look at the facts and say, damn, we need to do something different here because it's not working for us.
Absolutely. I think that I want you to drill down into at least kind of one example that can help us really kind of see this. And I want to point out a couple things here, actually. When we kind of mentioned the gap between the GDP and the actual, you know, what we saw in terms of jobs kind of locally. You've also mentioned the report that, you know, and you've talked about it here too as well, that we've also seen a loss of population, right? So instead of people coming to the area, we still have people leaving the area, right? Which was a problem that preceded this. And, you know, you say in the report that basically all three measures of prosperity, income, jobs, and population, that these across the 22 counties, like with some very small exceptions.
Some did better than others.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so you have a range there, but on a whole across the area, it's a loss, like a straight loss. The case that you focus in on kind of at one point here, I got a tag, I'm just bringing it up here, is this about Belmont County, Ohio.
Yeah.
Right. Can you take us into this? Because I had to go back and read this like three different times just because just the impact seems so devastating.
Yeah. I mean, Belmont County, Ohio is kind of a special case because for those who read the report, you'll see that of the 22 counties between the three states, seven of them are in Ohio. And of the seven in Ohio, Belmont County is by far the largest gas-producing state. That one county alone is responsible for a third of all the natural gas coming out of Ohio and has received more than a third of all the investment in the state. And that's what makes the results that were realized there, because you'd think, well, that's got to be the place in Ohio, since it got the most investment and it's doing the most, that should get the best results. Well, in fact, what has happened in Belmont County is that they have seen exactly the opposite happen. In employment, Belmont County actually had job losses of about 7%.
Now, again, 7% job loss.
they lost 16, yeah. Now, what you have to understand, though, is that Belmont County also, when you look at GDP just for that one county, do you remember how I said for the 22 counties as a group, they had, you know, their rate of GDP growth was three times that of the nation?
Yep.
If you look just at Belmont County, it was five times the rate of the nation. Five, right? This county saw more economic growth as measured by GDP than just about any place you can imagine. But its number of jobs actually declined from 24,000 down to just over 22,000.
Wow.
And that actually, I think, puts this, it throws what has happened into high relief.
Yeah.
Because if any place should have benefited from this, given the level of investment that went in, it should have been Belmont County, Ohio. And it just didn't happen. And I will tell you one other thing that just, frankly, it infuriates me. The Ohio Oil and Gas Association has started a campaign to try to refute the findings of the report. And one of the claims that they're making is that how could we have lost jobs when throughout this entire period, the unemployment rate was going down? And you know what? They're right. It did go down. But what they don't tell you is there are two ways you can reduce your unemployment rate. One good and one bad. The good way is you add jobs and therefore you reduce the number of unemployed people. Mm-hmm. But there is a bad way of doing it. And the bad way is instead of increasing the numerator, you decrease the denominator.
Exactly.
You lose workers from your economy even faster than you lose jobs. And that is what happened in Belmont County. And frankly, if you had to take a choice between having an unemployment rate that's rising or an unemployment rate that is declining while you're also losing jobs and while you're also losing workers, you would much rather have the rising unemployment rate. Because when you're losing, when you have a declining unemployment rate amid a loss of jobs, it means you're getting a double whammy.
Right.
It means you're not only losing jobs, but you're losing, you're degrading your talent pool. You're losing your labor force. And that has long-term repercussions because it means it's even harder going into the future to turn that economy around. Because the first thing that employers look for when they expand in an area or move to an area is the labor force.
Exactly.
Is the talent there to support the business that I'm doing. And so those counties in Ohio led by Belmont County are getting that double whammy. They're not just losing jobs. They're seeing their talent pool degraded, which will make it even harder for them going into the future to come back from this. And that makes, you know, the claims of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association when they try to cite the declining unemployment rate as a benefit, I mean, that I'm afraid is just willfully misleading to their listeners. And I think that is an awful thing to do.
It is. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. And I just want to like nail that in one more time. You're talking about a 60%. Okay, first of all, here, the oil and gas sector makes up nearly 60% of the county's economy.
Yeah.
Right. And then you saw while you had this huge increase to the national GDP, you had a 7% decline in jobs and a 5% decline in population.
Yep.
It's astonishing.
And I should add, for those who are listening to this, you know, you can go to the OhioRiverValleyInstitute.org website, and you can see the report. And in the report, we don't only show the percentages, we show the raw numbers for every county. There's nothing secret here. There's no magic going on. The numbers are right there for God and the world to see.
Absolutely. And you guys, anybody who's listening to us on our podcast, you want to listen to our YouTube show, make sure you just go in the show notes. Like all this is going to be linked there right in the show notes, link you to the Ohio River Valley Institute, link you directly to this report. And I do recommend, look, and this is not, I understand that, you know, you hear like numbers and data and things like this, and you might be like, oh my God, my eyes are going to glaze over. I can promise you, your eyes will not glaze over this report. I mean, not only do you have the raw data there, do you have the kind of the figures like we're talking about here, but it's well written and kind of takes you right through like this kind of compare and contrast between the promise, right, and the reality. And the impacts are pretty like are hard to come to any other possible conclusion other than this has just been devastating. And it will continue to be devastating, right? So, you know, right now, even if we were to take the most, say, generous reading of the expectations of coming in, right? Let's just say that there were some really good oil and gas executives that came in and they really wanted to contribute to the economy. Like I said, this is a hypothetical, so I'm just saying, even if we assume that at this point in time, right, and after seeing the figures that are presented in this report, there, if those same arguments are used now, then they are nothing but lies. Because we have the data, right? We've seen what goes on. And unless they're going to have some radical kind of change and say, listen, we're going to accept a 20% severance tax increase to make up for the loss that we brought to these counties, it's just not going to, you know, it's just nothing but smoke. Right. So this is a really important point. Now, I would take a quick announcement, program announcement here. Then I want to come back to here. And I want Sean to tell us a little bit about some of the blowback. He's already talked a little bit about some of this, the ramping up to kind of start to refute this report and some of that kind of blowback. And we'll also take your call. So we'll come back after this. We'll start talking a little about some of the blowback. And then if you do have something, you have a comment that you want to kind of chime in, you have a question for Sean, you have a comment, you got some experience that you want to bring into the show, we'd welcome you into the conversation. Also, on our YouTube, if you're following us on YouTube, you're watching the show there, if you got a comment there, you can put it right in the chat. But I just want to let everybody know that on a programming note for next Monday night, same time, same channel, next Monday night, that's March 8th, I'm going to be welcoming State Representative Elizabeth Fiedler and State Senator Nikhil Saval to the show. And we're going to be talking about the people's budget and progressive organizing this state. And again, that's going to be live once again. The Podbean app, and we'll be streaming live on YouTube channel quite as well. My guess is we're going to have a conversation that's going to go beyond just the people's budget, in part because we're in budgeting season right now, and there's been a whole bunch of stuff that's been going down in the state legislature in terms of housing policy and a bunch of other stuff. So please do tune in next week. I'd love to have you. And you can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. And you can give us some love right now during this show. There's that little gift icon at the bottom of your Podbean app. You click on that, you can send us a gift. Any gift that you give us today, right, will help support the show and help expand it. You remember last week we had a special Wednesday show with Jordan Hopkins. We talked about kind of extremist organizing in the state and some of the pushback and the grift that's at the center of the Patriot Party. That was kind of a midweek show. We hope to bring you some more midweek shows just like that. And we can only make that possible with your support. So kind of really appreciate it. So as a reminder, if you got any questions, comments, you want to phone in, you want to share your experience, please do hit that little call button at the bottom of your Podbean app. So Sean, take us into this now. You kind of mentioned this to me before we got on the show today, that there's been some increasing pushback now to this report, despite the fact that it's very factual. Here's the numbers. This is what the numbers mean. These are the impacts. Already there seems to be this mobilizing by the industry.
Well, there is, and clearly they feel vulnerable on this issue because for so long, the debate over fracking has been framed pretty much as one of jobs versus the environment. And as long as they kept it in that frame, you know, to be perfectly honest, you know, I think most people value jobs more than they do the environment.
Yeah.
And so they felt that as though that was a beneficial framing. The challenge that this report creates is that it goes after the family jewels. It's going after their economic claims rather than their environmental claims.
Right.
And that's why it's fundamentally, I think, very frightening to them. And yes, they've been mobilizing on a number of fronts. As I mentioned, I may have mentioned before, two congressmen in Ohio have issued press releases condemning the report. The Ohio Oil and Gas Association has started a roadshow in the seven counties in eastern Ohio, trying to refute the report. Pittsburgh Works Together, an organization that is very supportive of the industry, issued a press release, which it circulated to all members of the Pennsylvania legislature attempting to refute the report. And the funny thing is that the arguments that they're making are so transparently false. I mean, I talked about a few minutes ago about the unemployment rate claims, which statistically is just laughable. The Pittsburgh Works Together refutation basically argued that we had cited the wrong federal employment statistics. Now, first, you have to understand that we cited the same statistics that the federal government uses when it reports job numbers every month, that the state of Pennsylvania, all 50 states use. We use the same source. They suggested using
another. Yeah, so basically the numbers that anybody has any interest whatsoever is coming to like an approximating objective reading of the scenario. Those are the numbers you're talking about that you used, right?
Yeah, and we have, you know, we at the Ohio River Valley Institute have an advisory board that includes a number of prominent economists. From Pennsylvania, one of those who's looked at this is Steve Herzenberg from Keystone Research, yep. With whom you may be familiar.
Yep.
But we've got Mark Partridge from Ohio State University, Amanda Weinstein from the University of Akron, and a number of other people. And they frankly were flabbergasted when they heard the criticism that we used the wrong numbers, as in, what else would you use? Well, the interesting thing is that the other numbers that they used from a source called the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is a federal agency, is not actually a count of jobs. It's a count of people who work. Mm-hmm. And there is a difference, because people, do a lot of things to make money and get by in this world. And some of them are in jobs and some of them are doing other things. But the funny thing about the numbers that they came up with is that even if you use their numbers, instead of, we basically calculated when we went through this whole thing, the fracking industry for all 22 counties in this, we could see the addition of only 5,600 jobs in these economies. And again, the industry had projected between the three states over 400,000. We could find only 5,000.
Well, that's 5, in the neighborhood. I mean, to be fair, Sean, that's in the neighborhood. I mean,
Well, but the funny part, but Kevin, the funny part is that, so we basically said that these guys are falling about like 97% short of the claim, right? The alternative numbers that have been offered in that criticism of our report are basically arguing, no, we only fell 94% short.
So you could be in this situation by just saying like, okay, look, just for the sake of argument, let's use your numbers. Okay, we'll go with 94. Just for the sake of argument, let's go with your 90% failure rate. How about that? Holy cow.
Yeah, we found 5,600 jobs. They found about 15,000. Again, as compared to the 450,000. I mean, it's like, whatever, guys.
So they're using like the wrong numbers, right, in order to show their own failures, right? And think that's only because it's a 3 percentage point difference for what you find that they think that's a victory? Is that it? I mean,
yeah, this is, we've seen this in national politics for, the last few years. I mean, what's happening is they're not actually trying to make the case. What they are trying to do is undermine the credibility. They're flooding the zone with crap
to try to
undermine the credibility of the report and, frankly, undermine any numbers that are out there. Because any numbers that are factual and reported are going to work against them. And so just as, frankly, with the Trump administration, what you try to do is undermine even the concept of objective numbers and actual findings. Because there's no place else to go with this.
It's remarkable. I mean, that I mean, if this did not impact people's lives so much, this would be a comedy. I mean, it's the insanity of being able to kind of say that you're all wrong, that you're making up these numbers, and then admitting of your gross failures and calling that an argument in support of your industry is, I mean, I don't even know what to do with that. I seriously don't even know what to do with that. And especially when you're talking about, like, I mean, real people's livelihoods are on the line here. I mean, you're talking about regions across the Ohio River Valley who have been, this is not the first round of decimation for extractivists and industries. I mean, this is not round one. And so you're talking about kind of histories and family histories of being devastated by some version of this industry. And it leaves me in this place where I get so frustrated because I'm like, when do we learn the lesson? Right. I mean, when do we kind of learn the lesson? And, and I was really happy to hear your hopefulness about this, that, we're actually at a point where there's an opening. right? And, you know, mm-hmm. I have to say that, you know, it does seem like there's a lot of things coming together at once, right? We have, on the one hand, we have the, you know, the absolute need for, like, dramatic action on the climate crisis. And then you have, you know, reports coming out. You finally seem like, you know, this, you know, the Delaware River Basin Commission seems to have finally come to a consensus. I mean, because for the longest time, you know, that they've been trying to deal with this for years. And Delaware, at one point, was saying, no, we're not going to sign on. So they dropped it, that it's been punted. And now they're saying, no, we're actually seeing the impact on the environmental score, like on the waters and watersheds and looking at fracking fluids. And then you have on the economic end of things, the promises have not been panned out. And so, you know, in some ways, I mean, this is an overused, you know, term, but you have, say, a perfect storm, or at least a perfect opportunity right now, it seems to me, to really chart a different direction, one that actually can be about job creation, can be about kind of responding to the climate crisis, and can be about saving the environment all in one.
I think that's absolutely true. And going back to something that you said earlier is important, and that is this industry has been working flat out for more than a decade. I mean, you could perhaps attribute some potential if we were in a situation for the last 11 years, the industry had only been operating at, you know, 60 or 70% of capacity. And you could say, yeah, but if we get this thing really cranked up, so we're close to 100%, then, you know, the benefits will just land upon us. But in fact, that's not the case. The industry has been running flat out. If something good was going to happen, it would have happened.
Right.
You know, and I think that's when in the report I refer to the issues, the barriers to prosperity as being structural, that's specifically what I mean. That you can't sell your way out of this. There's no, you can't just generate more volume and expect this problem to be solved. It's not going to change the underlying dynamics that are consistent here.
Wow. Oh,
and the other point, you just rattled off, you described it as the perfect storm, where you have a confluence
yep.
of forces that are coming together. There's one other really important one that we all need to think about as a region, and that is that the opportunity for growth in natural gas production is itself coming close to what is a plateau, and it may relatively soon go into decline. You know, there are only so many coal-fired power plants left to be retired. That number is beginning to dwindle. And there is pushback, as you pointed out, on the environmental front against things like plastics
mm-hmm,
that
right.
are made from natural gas liquids and derivatives. And also, when you look even at the electric industry, which consumes the majority of natural gas, by the way,
mm-hmm.
there are lower cost alternatives out there. Renewable resources, both onshore and offshore wind, are now less expensive than natural gas. And when you look at the projections for where Pennsylvania in particular seems to be going, particularly if the state joins the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative,
yep.
you're going to see not a huge decline in natural gas, because a lot of the infrastructure has been built and it's now a fact of life.
Yep.
But you will see a flattening of growth there. And that means, again, the opportunities for gas are likely to go, if not into decline, they're going to become much, much more dependent on exports to other countries. And the other factor that I would point out that has not played out and in all likelihood is not going to play out is that the petrochemical industry, plastics, has not grown the way in which it was anticipated to grow. And that's another area that I concentrate on heavily and have written quite a lot about, and in fact just hosted a forum a couple of weeks ago with industry experts, finance experts, and policymakers on the future of the plastics and petrochemical industries in the region. And that also is not encouraging. But kind of the last factor that I would chime in with on that front is all of these industries, whether we're talking about natural gas or whether we're talking about petrochemicals and plastics, these are intense, capital-intensive industries, not labor-intensive.
Right.
If you had to pick industries upon which to try to rebuild an economy that provides lots of jobs, you really couldn't have chosen too many worse places to go. And to put that in context, when you look at extractive industries, oil, natural gas, and also coal, only about 20% of the income that they generate goes to jobs, goes to wages and salaries. When you look at other sectors, most sectors of the economy are up around 50 to 60%. In other words, these are inherently not labor-intensive activities to begin with.
Right.
And then you layer in all of these other factors, and you see this just isn't a great foundation upon which to try to build economic growth and job growth.
100%. Well, I'll tell you, you know, we're coming up on time here, but if anybody does want to kind of jump in, does want to kind of call in, if you got any questions or comments, please do now. And I'll tell you, one thing you can help out a lot is, like, you know, you listen on Podbean, make sure you like the show, make sure you follow the show, give us a like and share it with your friends. I want to, you know, special kind of shout out to Kristen, who kind of shared it with some friends during the show. That's fantastic. And you can also help by heading on over to our YouTube channel. Even if you're not on YouTube a lot, go over there, hit that subscribe button, hit that little notification bell to basically, you know, be notified anytime that we go live, and like this stream, because the more that you kind of like and subscribe to, whether this podcast or whether it's a YouTube channel, the more that helps amplify these voices that we kind of bring on here every week. So, I mean, Sean, I'll tell you, I've, like I said at the very beginning of this, I've loved this report. It's infuriated me, and it's felt like such a needed contribution to the discussion at this point. And I am glad to hear that you've got some follow-up stuff, and I hope that, man, I can reach out to you again. I'd love to have you back on the show with some other reports. This stuff is just phenomenal.
No, this has been fun, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk, because this really is all about changing public discourse and building awareness of what's going on. And, you know, this is an important part of doing that. So I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
Well, you got it. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why we do this, too, is because, you know, it's one thing where, you know, if you go on, say, a local news show, if you go on to even like a national news show, I mean, you've got, like, you know, you've got your 1 or 2 minutes to basically, you know, make a few kind of, like, you know, like top line points, kind of little conclusion points, and a kind of where do we go from here kind of point. But they have the opportunity for people to hear the kind of, you know, the report discussed, see about the implications, and to participate in the discussion is something that I really appreciate. Well, we try to amplify in any way that we can. So, well, hey, thank you so much once again, Sean, for coming on the show. I appreciate it so much. I want to remind everybody out there that you can kind of become a member of Raging Chicken by going to patreon.com/RC Press. You can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. You can hit that little kind of like gift icon at the bottom of your Podbean app right now. You can send us a gift in any kind of amount. But most importantly, make sure you share the show and kind of make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube channel, subscribe to our podcast. The more that we get the word out, that we help amplify this. And we've been doing our live call-in shows now on Podbean since kind of, I think the first one we did was last July, at the end of last July, and we've already seen the kind of the sharing of the numbers kind of going way up and gotten some great feedback so far. And that's, you know, that's all to, you know, thanks to everybody out who listens to the show, thanks who follows it, and thanks to share this stuff out. So once again, this is Sean O'Leary. You can find his report, Appalachia's Natural Gas Counties, the Natural Gas Fracking Boom and Appalachia's Lost Decade. You can find that on the website of the Ohio River Valley Institute. There's going to be links to that directly in our show notes. Make sure you go and you check it out and get that report. It's available in PDF. You know, you get it, download it, and share it with your friends, because the more that you get this information out to people on the ground, the more that you can actually help kind of, you know, give the evidence, give the knowledge and the research background to help make the arguments on the ground for people who are trying to better our communities, the more, you know, we're all going to be in a better shape. So thanks again, Sean. I appreciate it. I look forward to, you know, the next drop of the next report.
Thank you, Kevin. I really appreciate it. Take care.
All right, you got it. Hey, everybody, so this has been Kevin Mahoney, an editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Thank you all for tuning in tonight. Great discussions in the chat. I loved having seen some new faces, some new voices in here. We're sharing and helping spread the word. Next week, we're going to have, once again, as I said at the break, we're going to have State Representative Elizabeth Fiedler and State Senator Nikhil Saval to come on and talk about the Pennsylvania People's Budget. There's been a lot of budget activity in the State House in Harrisburg, and we're going to have a lot to talk about. Especially when it comes to kind of the expansion of, you know, I like to say instead of the progressive squad here in Pennsylvania, we've actually just kind of like, you know, leveled up to the progressive battalion after the last election. So we're going to talk about that too as well next week. Hope to see you all back next week right here on Podbeans, Out to Coop Live. See you on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Man, this is leaves me with a bunch of hope at the beginning of the week. Can't ask for more than that. See ya! My face, my arms, can't tell if I exist. Am I the sky, the rock, or tree falling in the forest? I had a friend once, at least I think I did. I almost can't remember exactly.